morning. So we have a full agenda today. We will start with Senate Bill 26 and have Paul introduce that bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to Senator Monroe because I have two bills up in the committee next door, so I'm going to run next door and testify on those and hopefully make it back for Senate Bill 819, which would come after that, and then Senate Bill 28. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 26.
Okay. Thank you. We'll see you in a little bit.
Thanks.
Senate Bill 26. Mr. Vice Chair is here.
Stay with me.
Steve, is this yours?
No, I've got it. Senator.
Tell us all about Senate Bill 26.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 26 is sponsored by Senator Schrader, and we're thinking he will be here shortly. The bill describes procedures in the general fund and lottery revenue forecast process. Under current law, most of the things that are pretty much done by convention. For example, the statutes say there should be a quarterly forecast, but it doesn't really specify anything other than saying that the methodology should be described. So most of the forecasts you see now are pretty much done by convention. And what Senate Bill 26 does is kind of lay out some of the expectations of that forecast. For example, it talks about estimates for the current fiscal year and the next fiscal year, the two succeeding biennia. That's done in practice now, but it spells it out in statute. But the key change in Senate Bill 26 is that it requires a midpoint number for each biennium. Again, that's done now. And also a range above and below the midpoint that's based on a 95% confidence interval. And that confidence interval would be based on historical performance of the forecast. The bill requires that the governor and the legislature use that midpoint estimate for purposes of developing the budget. And that, again, is what is carried out in current practice. It does, in Section 3, spells out that if actual revenue exceeds the projected midpoint estimate, the amount above that midpoint estimate up to the top of the range is transferred into a rainy day fund established in subsection 1 in the bill. So it creates a revenue stream going into a rainy day fund. The key change, however, in terms of how it would affect the revenue stream is in the 2% surplus kicker calculation. And that really begins in Section 7, right at the bottom of page 5. Under current law, and indeed in the Constitution, it just states that the governor shall cause a forecast to be prepared as soon as practical after sine die. And what this bill would do is have the Department of Administrative Services, for purposes of determining the kicker base, use the highest number in that range. So in other words, it would use the upper bound of the 5% confidence interval for purposes of doing the 2% surplus kicker base. I did kind of a crude estimate for you for the current biennium, and on the back of your staff measure summary, it's on the back side of your staff measure summary. And it's called a kicker base calculation under Senate Bill 26. It's not precisely right because I didn't break out corporate and non-corporate, and I did use what was the September confidence interval. That's what I had in the forecast, and Michael can give you a better idea of how that's calculated. But if you just use those numbers there, you look at the close of session estimate was about $11.3 billion for 05-07. The top of that range would have been about $12.3 billion. 12,256. The current estimate now, these are all general fund numbers, is 12,733, 12.7 billion. The current kicker refund is about 1.4 billion. That's personal and corporate credits combined. If you use the top of that confidence interval, The difference, instead of $1.4 billion, would be about $477 million, and you'd have the difference between the top of the range and the midpoint estimate would be $929 million. And under this bill going forward, then that would be what would be deposited into the rainy day fund.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions for staff? If not, Senator Schrader, this is your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, temporary, sir, and existing chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. Appreciate a hearing on this bill. This bill is born of some of my frustrations, co-chair of Ways and Means, and trying to budget and predict what revenues we have available or not, what sort of investments we'd like to be making in our state or not, given the current volatility of our revenue source and the inability of our forecast to even come close in some cases, as the revenue staff has just indicated, to even predicting what our revenues are going to be. I think it's also pretty interesting that despite the huge impact this forecast has on the citizens of the state of Oregon and what we do in this assembly, there is no statutory reference, really, no statutory authority, if you will, that guides this revenue forecast. This is an attempt to put a revenue forecast with some broad overarching parameters into statute while not micromanaging the elements that would make up that forecast. I think it's, frankly, our duty to inculcate some of this into statute at this stage of the game. As I alluded to, compared to our compatriots in more stable revenue stream states like our good neighbor to the north, it is very, very difficult for our Office of Economic Analysis to predict with any degree of accuracy what the heck the forecast is. At the same time, as a very concerned, conservative, fiscally responsible businessman representing people of the state of Oregon, I would like to make sure there's some certainty and some budget discipline about how we budget here in the state. There's been a lot of interest in the kicker and its effects, both good and potentially not so good, on the citizens of the state. And so this legislation that you see before you is an attempt to put things together in a much more thoughtful and coherent manner than we currently have in determining what the forecast should or should not be, how we should budget and what we should budget to, and what should a realistic kicker actually be. This, as staff already indicated, this forecast actually more accurately shows there's a range. Every time the forecast is presented to us by Michael Kennedy and folks, there's a range that they talk about. And they're very honest with us about the relative accuracy and inaccuracy. I've chosen 95% accuracy, if you will, in this bill. There's nothing sacrosanct with that. If in the wisdom of this committee we need to narrow that or expand that, I'm certainly open to that. But I think the key thing is we have to have a range, give ourselves an opportunity to understand that the volatility of our revenue source requires us to have a range of accuracy, not a number that is just picked out of the air. Having said that, legislature and the governor in this bill are required to budget to the midpoint. So we cannot get carried away and assume that because there's this 5% upper deviation, we're going to budget to that high number, only to find out, because, again, of the volatility of the forecast and the revenue source, that we could tank, you know, very easily and then, of course, that by annum and be on the hook for making huge reductions in a budget we had approved maybe 6, 8, 10 months before. So while we have the upper end of the forecast, upper end of that range to be the actual forecast number that we worry about and make sure the revenue, you know, should not exceed, our actual budget is a much more conservative level, you know, five percentage points down at the midpoint. We don't interfere with the kicker operation. Anything above that official forecast, that 5% uptick, would then go into the would be returned to the voters as established in our Constitution. So we do not mess with the actual kicker itself. We also, though, have the advantage because there's, in this, the way this is constructed, there's room, if you will, between the budget level at the midpoint and that upper end of the forecast at 5%, money in that range could go to the new rainy day fund we've just recently established. This bill would have to be modified, obviously, to reflect the fact that we have now established a rainy day fund with some earlier great legislation put out by this committee and another committee. So to me, this is a a pretty good deal, I think, for us from a revenue standpoint, a ways and means standpoint, and I think for the citizens of the state, to have a much better way to more accurately predict the ebb and flow of our revenue sources, adopt a conservative fiscally budgeting stance, and yet maintain the integrity of the kicker for those people that feel that is something very, very important to them. So I'd entertain the committee's consideration.
Other questions for Senator Schrader? Kurt, I've read, and staff has indicated this, that our system is actually becoming more volatile because it seems like there's more and more tax liability is in the form of capital gains, mm-hmm. and capital gains are much less predictable even than regular earned income, and so the volatility situation isn't getting better, it's actually getting worse. And we're seeing that, and so it's even more difficult for those people that are trying to do a forecast to hit right on or even within a couple percentage points. Your bill, I think, would partially address that system by allowing us to forecast a range and to target for it. Anything for the senator? Kurt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'll have to talk to the chair as to whether we're going to move this bill or not.
That'd be fine. Do you want me to do 28 an hour? You have me come back on that, sir.
Can you come back in about 20 minutes or sure. half an hour?
Thank you, sir.
Great, we'll call you. Michael Kennedy's here.
Okay, Michael Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. For the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. Here to answer any questions.
The question is this Senate Bill 26, I'm sure you've reviewed it. Do you think it would work as intended?
Mr. Chair, in terms of our office implementing the bill, as staff has indicated, the majority of sort of the requirements in there are already carried out in practice in terms of forecasting a midpoint, calculating sort of the expected variance around that midpoint, the potential for revenues to come in above or below. In general, most of those issues are already carried out in practice and presented.
Okay. So, questions? Senator Starr?
I guess I'd throw a question out there, and it might be a question for staff up here, and maybe, but it seems to me that's what this bill does, then, if it doesn't change what we're already doing, all it does is whatever comes in above the forecast now, then, which is above 2%, goes back, all of it goes back to the voters, taxpayers, in a kicker check. What this bill, the only change that this bill contemplates is capturing 5% of whatever that amount is into the rainy day fund and thereby reducing the amount of money that goes back to the taxpayers and kicker checks. Did I read that right?
Senator Starr, what it does is it changes the kicker base, and so it raises it to the top of the range. As Michael said, they're already doing that, but of course the kicker is based off that midpoint estimate now. So it would change the calculation, and it wouldn't necessarily be 5%. It would be that 95% confidence interval. So, yes, it would be the top of the range, and that would have the effect of reducing kicker refunds and credits in the future.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Kennedy?
Mr. Chair, if I may, there are a few more technical issues in terms of implementing this. As Paul has mentioned, we currently only use sort of a general fund variance historically to provide that range, whereas now, because you have two different kicker bases, you have the corporate and then you have the all other, we would actually be producing additional information. One would be that high end of the range, close of session corporate forecast, and then the upper limit for just the corporate revenues. And that variance is going to be different from sort of the overall and or the all other, because corporate is much more volatile than the other sources. So there's going to be more information that we will be putting out that then the legislature would use for budgeting purposes and calculation purposes.
Sure. So Michael, how if we implemented Senate Bill 26, how would that change? You're in the middle of doing the May forecast right now. How would that alter your work on the May forecast?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert. One of the first things we would have to do in terms, one of the issues you have here is we, as we have said, we use the historical variance of these revenue streams to get an indication of what we expect the future variance to be. And I would imagine that we would want to sit down with a group to talk about the relevant historical time frame, because you can use any given time frame you want. You would want to use the time frame you feel best reflects what you're going to be experiencing in the future. Obviously, the last 20 years are a pretty good indication given what we're experiencing in terms of the volatility. So we would want to work very hard to make the best choices there in terms of a time frame for the calculation of these confidence intervals, the actual percentage expected deviations. That would be one of the first things I think we would want to do, is really tighten those down and produce the methodology. And I think we would end up coming in front of you and presenting that methodology and making sure that you understood exactly what decisions had been made.
Okay. Senator George?
A few years ago, the numbers were manipulated for the purpose of taking $107 million out of the kicker by changing the MUPL dollars. This appears to me to be the exact same motive, and that is to eliminate the kicker, which the people have wisely put into the Constitution because they were afraid we would do this. It would appear to me that we're talking about almost $1 billion here that would be removed, if the kicker calculation looked like it does today. My question is, isn't there a temptation that you're asking for direction from us on who builds the top number? Is that you could always build a top number that made sure there wasn't a kicker?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, in theory, yes, which is why then in practice I would say you would want a very transparent calculation of that range. And you can get there because obviously there is a historical, variance. There is historical data to use. You would just want it to be very transparent and very clear exactly that you were in compliance basically with the intent of this legislation.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up statement. I appreciate the word transparent because I think it's transparent what's happening here today with this bill. And with that, I will be quiet. See, and I have vertigo right now, so anything I say could be discredited.
other questions for Mr. Kennedy? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 26? Is there anybody else we want to subpoena?
I think Michael was here just for that bill in particular.
In that case, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 26. Where do you want me to go now?
We'll just I'm going to not go to my hearing next door. Okay, so we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 819. And Paul, we've got the bill itself, and then we have our first complete amendment where remove everything in the bill and replace it. And I think the governor's office and the Department of Revenue is here to talk about the amendment. Mm-hmm. Go to Paul first for an overview.
Mr. Chair, I just have written out a paragraph really just based on discussions with the Department of Revenue and the governor's office. And 819-1 we got this morning, which spells out what the changes are, and as you pointed out, the dash ones replace the bill. Based on those discussions, what the amendment does is change the calculation for distributing the 2% surplus kicker refunds and credits. Of course, now we have the corporate credit has in effect been suspended for the next 2 years, but the bill would affect that going forward. Under current law, those refunds and credits are based on tax liability net of credit. So it's, as you think about your tax form, you go through and you calculate, you apply your tax rate and determine what your tax bill will be, and then you have a list of credits you can take, and that gives you your net tax after credits. That's the way the kicker distribution is determined now. You take that tax net of credits. What this bill would do is it would make the credit determined by your taxes or your refund determined by taxes before credits. So this would have the effect. One effect, and I know this is the intent of the proponents of the dash one, is to make the credits more attractive to taxpayers during those kicker credit refund years. 819, the amendment would not affect the overall size of the kicker. So the surplus calculation would be done in the same way. The difference would be when the state economists at the end of the biennium would take the amount of revenue above the forecast for both personal and corporate and would compare that with the close of session forecast. If it's greater than 2%, then you trigger the kicker. So, and that becomes the entire amount above the close of session estimate. The difference would be in calculating the percentage for the refund, or in the case of corporations, for the credit. You divide that total amount of the surplus not by the estimated liability after credits, but by the estimated liability before credits. That would be a bigger number, and that would have the effect of reducing the percentage allocation, because you're allocating to a larger number. However, it would not affect the total amount that's distributed. So the 2% surplus as a revenue limit would remain in place. The only thing that would be changed is how that's distributed back to general taxpayers. And those that have a higher usage of credits would be the beneficiaries of that change. One thing I'll point out about credits, just to remind you, as you look at your tax expenditure book, remember how we do the personal exemption credit, and this came up in Measure 41 this fall, but that is done as a credit, unlike the federal government, and that's about 80% of the personal credits we have is through the personal exemption credit. So those that have, you know, a lot of personal exemption credits would be beneficiaries of this change.
Questions for Paul? Is anyone here on Senate Bill 819, not the dash ones, just the give you an opportunity to testify if you're here, just on the content of the bill? No. Okay, so Tim Nesbitt, Elizabeth Harshenko, Michael Graney to talk about the dash one amendments. I think responding to, I don't know if other offices have been inundated with letters. I certainly have, of folks that are not able to market the tax credits that we have approved.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor, and with me are Elizabeth Harshenko and Michael Graney. As Paul Warner described, the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, the Senate Bill 819, changes the way in which the kicker is distributed to taxpayers. But as Mr. Warner also noted, and I'll repeat, the amendment does not change the amount of the kicker, which is set by Article 9, Section 14 of the Constitution. Instead, it relies on your authority under that same section to determine how the kicker is distributed. The change made by the Dash 1 amendment is this. Instead of calculating the kicker as a percentage of a taxpayer's tax liability after deductions and credits, it calculates the kicker as a percentage of a taxpayer's tax liability before credits. We're proposing this change to correct unexpected consequences that arise when tax credits interact with the kicker. Our tax credits were designed to promote certain public purposes, from earned income tax credits and child care credits for working families, to energy tax credits and cultural trust credits that are meant to be attractive to higher income taxpayers. But the market for the latter, especially pass-through credits, has been constrained by the prospect of this year's personal kicker. We've received complaints, and I know you have too, from representatives of taxpayers who donated to the cultural trust or purchased energy tax credits expecting tax benefits that will now be made moot by the personal kicker. Further, not only will credits already used turn out to be unusable or diminished in value, but the unpredictability of kickers will make the value of these credits in the future a lot less certain. Thus, the financing for public purposes that these credits support, whether it's alternative energy development or cultural programs, will be diminished. We can avoid this impact by applying the kicker to an individual's tax liability before credits. This will solve the problem caused by the interaction of the kicker with the credits and allow these credits to function as intended. This will have no effect, again, on the amount of kicker dollars to be refunded to taxpayers, but will change the distribution of those dollars. We looked at the distributional effect of this change to make sure it would not have a negative effect on low and moderate income taxpayers. What we found is that this change will be slightly positive for those taxpayers. They will get a little more on average, especially those who benefit from the earned income tax credit and child care credits. Higher income taxpayers who don't take advantage of the credits will get a little less. And more taxpayers will get a kicker. When you think of the number of working families who end up with zero tax owed because they have their earned income tax credit or the Working Families Child Care credit, they will now get a kicker check in the mail. So this passes our fairness test, but it also solves the problem that gave rise to the whole inquiry in the first place, and that is maintaining the relationship between the credits and the tax liability that we have right now for the energy tax credits, the cultural trust credit, and the film and video production credit. So those public purposes are preserved. The kicker is preserved. The kicker is, in a sense, extended to more working families who otherwise wouldn't receive a refund. And we think this solves a problem and has a beneficial side effect as well. So we urge your support. And with that, I'll ask Ms. Harshenko to give you more perspective from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. My testimony, I think the significant portion of that gives you just a couple of examples of the change in the calculation. The first example that I give you is a family of four with a tax bill of $2,000 who would have $886 in credits, personal exemption credit for each of the family members, and perhaps a cultural trust credit of $250. And under the current law, their kicker check would be for the projected kicker for this fall, based on the percentage that has been set forth in the forecast to date, would be about $434. If the Dash 1 amendment is approved and made applicable to the kicker that will be paid in this fall, the credits would be disregarded. Their tax liability that would be the basis for distributing the kicker would actually be $2,886, and their kicker amount would be $586. The second example shows you how this varies depending upon the proportion that credits bear to the total tax liability of the taxpayer. A single individual with that same tax bill of $2,000 after credits perhaps only would have one credit, which would be the personal exemption credit of $159. That person, under current law, would also get a $434 check, but under the Dash 1 amendments would get a $438 check because their liability before credits would be that $2,159, slightly slower, lower percentage amount of the kicker credit or that would be calculated as a percent of their liability before credit. So it just shows you that the greater the proportion of total tax that is covered by credits, the more impact the Dash 1 amendments will have for a taxpayer in that situation. The smaller the proportion that credits bear to the total tax liability, the lesser the impact. I'd also like to just show you in the amendments where these changes occur. There are a couple of other changes that I'd like to call to your attention.
Elizabeth, before we go there, can we
yes.
pause for just a couple of questions on mm-hmm. these examples? Are these actual taxpayers, or are these that y'all can pull anonymously, or are these fictitious just to represent?
Mr. Chair, this is make-believe. It's not a particular taxpayer. The average taxpayer pays around $2,000 in tax after credits. What I tried to do was just give you examples that would illustrate the way in which the change would operate, not to show you a specific taxpayer, just a representative example so you could see how the arithmetic would work.
And can you also provide an example of, these are two examples of where obviously folks are using, whether it's the personal exemption credit or the cultural trust or others, it would be, I think, helpful at least for full vision to have an example of the taxpayer that is not going to receive as much in their, just so we know how the dollars flow both ways back and forth.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, if one of those examples were changed, if the second example were changed so that the total tax bill was more in the range of $5,000, you would see the change go in the other direction. But if you'd like, I'll be happy to get an example and provide it to Paul to distribute to the committee.
Yeah, it would just be helpful to
okay.
get a clear vision of of and understand the goal here is just to ensure that Oregonians who are hoping to get the tax credits that they purchased or were marketed, actually are able to avail themselves of that tax credits that we put in the statute. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Elizabeth, the question is this, is that currently when the calculation for kicker return is made, the distribution reflects pretty much, very close to what the amount of money that they actually paid in.
Yes.
This changes that dramatically. Is that correct? Particularly the higher income folks.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's correct. The current distribution is tied pretty much to dollars paid in, a percent of your dollars that you actually paid in. The change would look back to what your liability was before the credits that offset the amount of dollars that you have to pay in. So you're right. It changes it in that way. And to the extent that there is a significant amount of tax credit that offsets liability and reduces what your payment would be, that would be disregarded.
And we should also, and I bet you Mr. Graney gets into this, the ramifications of doing nothing, just be aware of. But I don't want to, I know you had, we jumped in and before the second part of your testimony.
Okay, all I wanted to do was just take you through the significant portions of the amendments and
sure.
Just take a minute. If you look at page 3, at the top of the page, lines 2 and 3, this is related to the corporate kicker, which is now paid in the form of a tax credit against taxes due in the subsequent tax year. And it specifies that the credit will be determined based on the tax liability shown on the return or as corrected by the department, computed before the allowance of any other credit. So that's the change in under current law. It's after the allowance of credits. The language on line 3 that says, or as corrected by the Department of Revenue, just clarifies for us that the distribution is going to be based on true liability, and if so, if someone amends the return or if we correct a return because the tax was calculated incorrectly, the kicker would be adjusted so that it was reflecting the ultimate liability that was determined for the taxpayer. The parallel amendment for the individual kicker is lines 25 through 30, stating that tax liability for purposes of the refund that's made for individual income taxpayers is the amount shown on the return or as corrected by the department, computed before the allowance of any credit or offset against liability. So if you think about how when you fill out your tax return, of course you start with your federal return and move the information over, but you get to taxable income and then the tax on that taxable income, and then you start to reduce the amount of tax that you have to pay by prepayments, credits, and so it would be that tax that was calculated on your taxable income that would be the base. Turning to page 4 of the dash 1 draft amendments, you'll see a change on line 6, which says that for purposes of the refund, the department would have until December 15th in order to get checks out. And the reason for this amendment is if you decide that you would like to have this process apply to the kicker that will be issued this fall, these amendments don't specify that, but if you were to decide that, we would need a couple extra weeks to make sure we've done all the programming correctly. And so we would want to have that end date of by when those checks have to be issued extended by 2 weeks. If you decide that this is something you want to do prospectively, not for the kicker that's going to be paid this fall, then we wouldn't need that extended date.
You need it just for this.
We would need it if you wanted to.
Just for this year's
kicker
checks.
Just for this time, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Elizabeth, kicker used to be calculated as a credit against the next year's tax liability. And a few years ago, they started mailing out these checks. How much does it cost to actually mail out individual checks for the kicker?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, the last time we had a personal kicker was 2003, I believe, and 2001, excuse me. And at that time, with the postage rates at the time, it was just under $1 million to send out all of the checks. The amount of money that it costs in order to issue the kicker refund checks is deducted from the amount to be sent back. So we meet with the emergency board basically and say, okay, here's our estimate postage, the fees that are charged for issuing checks, the cost of the check stock, the cost of the envelopes, the labor and everything else. We add all that up. They give us some expenditure limitation, and then it's specifically taken out of the amount of money that's going to be sent back so that we're paid for
that. So the folks out there would get $1 million more value if you calculated it the old way and it became a credit against their next year's tax liability.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, we wouldn't incur those costs, and there would be, yes, there would be that additional amount of money that would be subject to distribution.
Thank you.
That's what the original bill, of course, does. Mm-hmm. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, if you told me you were going to take my money for that small percentage, $1 million out of $1 billion, I would tell you, give me my money now, I'll take the loss. And so, because it'll actually be a gain with that much money. The other question is I know we can get this number, is how much money do the taxpayers of Oregon spend in preparation to send the money to us? And so, to me, it's really the comparison of what they spend to prepare their taxes, to provide us with the money, is way beyond anything that we would spend to return the money that rightfully belongs to them. And I guess that's not a question, but do you have anybody have an idea what the estimate is of what the taxpayers spend to calculate their taxes? Okay.
Rob Douglas back there is hiding because he's afraid we might ask the accountants for some. Okay, so now we've been walked through the dash ones, and those are the three substantive changes that are embedded in the dash ones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Graney. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. We have been directly impacted by this problem. Let me explain briefly. We have a business energy tax credit provides a tax credit for investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy. Been a very popular program. A few years ago, you provided the ability for us to transfer that tax credit. And what that does, normally that tax credit's taken over 5 years, and a company with tax liability can pay the present value of that tax credit to the business or organization that actually made the investment, and then they take the tax credit over the 5 years. That provides a cash payment directly to reduce the cost of the investment. It's been critical for renewable energy development because typically people involved in renewable energy have had limited tax liability. Many of them are small companies, startup companies, or just begun a presence in Oregon in their investments in renewable energy. So it's been absolutely critical. Over half of the projects the last few years that have used our tax credit have in fact used this pass-through transfer mechanism as well. And we had over 700 of those this last year in terms of businesses and others with tax liability willing to pay for the tax credit. But the impact of the problem we have right now is that currently for the first 3 months of this year, we have no businesses willing to serve as pass-through partners and make that transfer payment. So it has definitely impacted our program, and it's I think put at risk the financial climate for investing in renewable energy that would make those projects cost effective.
So, and Mike, can you? I mean, you did it, but can you give us a more real life, like Ms. Harshenko did with the example one, so we just as vividly as possible see. Mm-hmm. What Oregon would be without, or a company or an individual would be without, if we retained the current, I've certainly got it in legal briefs from many law firms of their clients, but I think it'd be helpful to paint a real just vivid picture of actual people or companies.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a couple of examples. We've got wind developers for small projects, and these would be in the $10 million range and 5 to 10 megawatt range, that relying on the transfer mechanism of the tax credit will give them a 25% payment right now to reduce the cost of that from $10 million to $7.5 million if they have a partner that will take the tax credit over the 5 years. And we've had a number of projects that have relied upon that mechanism in terms of putting together their financial packages with investors based on that difference in calculation. And with the uncertainty of the pass-through transfer payment, some of those projects may not go forward, they've told me. We've also had examples in the past where schools and transit districts that don't pay taxes have been able to take advantage of this program as well through partnering with a business. And those projects would not be able to go forward. And those have been for energy efficiency investments.
Questions for this panel? Thank you. I know you had to work really fast and hard to deal with this emerging issue that, I don't know, a year ago I didn't know it was out there, and it seems to be affecting a lot of taxpayers, at least I'm hearing from some.
Well, and thank you very much for taking this issue up so quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Stephen McGrath is the only other individual that signed up to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm here to speak in favor of the Dash 1 as proposed. I am a solar developer in Portland, Oregon, and we have been impacted directly by this, as you've asked for examples. We have a
McGrath.
I'm sorry.
I just have to, the protocol, you have to say I'm Stephen McGrath. I'm from.
I apologize. Stephen McGrath from Portland.
Great.
My apologies. We are I work with as part of a solar developer in Portland, and we have been impacted by this directly. We have been working with several banks to try to get them to take pass-through or otherwise make use of these tax credits, and their uncertainty in this issue has precluded them from moving forward on projects. Our focus is on projects that benefit the nonprofit or government sector, such as schools and larger nonprofits that own their own facilities that want to do solar installations. And this is directly impacting our ability to finance these projects. So I would like to speak in favor of moving forward on this as expeditiously as possible. So thank you.
Great. Questions for Mr. McGrath? Can you, it's always helpful to just get examples like Mr. Graney gave, if you have just one that comes to mind of working with U.S. Bank to do X.
All right. Working with Bank of America, and we are looking to try to put together a package to finance a 768-kilowatt solar installation on the rooftop of Portland Rehabilitation Center in northeast Portland. This is a new facility of theirs. This would be the largest installation in the Northwest. But I have been told by Bank of America that they are, at this point, uncertain about the prospect for being able to use the business energy tax credit for this project, and that, of course, impacts their assessment of any return on any involvement in the project. If I may, I would like to also add that I would speak in favor of making this retroactive. One of the issues here is the issue of credibility of the value of these credits, and if we do not make it retroactive, there will be less credibility as to the value of these credits going forward.
You mean retroactive for this tax year?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Yeah. Questions for Mr. McGrath? Thank you for coming to Salem.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Senate Bill 819? Didn't know if you were just going for a jog or coming up there.
I apologize. I didn't get signed up because I was at another meeting. For the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, speak in favor of the Dash 1 amendments. The pass-through of the Betsy is the piece that allows local governments, municipal utilities in my case, to work with private sector partner to develop renewable energy and conservation resources. We have, there's a project right now in Ashland, a solar project that the city hopes to issue bonds on in June, and right now they can't get a pass-through partner. So, if they are able to get a pass-through partner, they could increase the size of the facility because they would plow the savings back into the project. So, it is an issue that we're very concerned about and urge your support for these amendments.
Great, thank you. Questions for Mr. O'Connor? Thank you. Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 819. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 28. If we could give the sponsor a call, Barbara. Thanks for hanging with us, Steve. Last bill of the day.
Mr. Chair, Committee Senate Bill 28 deals with urban renewal agencies and school districts. What the bill does would be to require urban renewal agencies to include school capital construction and improvement costs in their urban renewal plans when the plan is financed by tax increment financing. The school districts would be have their tax increment dollars put into a special fund, and that fund then would have to be used to pay principal and interest on indebtedness that was issued to finance the school capital projects within the plan. It would also allow the Urban Renewal Agency to enter into intergovernmental agreements with the school districts to basically work with the capital projects and to administer the funding for those capital projects generated by the school district's portion of the tax increment financing. It would apply to urban renewal plans adopted after July 1, 2008 or substantially altered after that, and would it take effect on the 91st day after signing died. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I misread the start date for this bill. There's two start dates at the end of the bill, and I picked up the wrong one. It does take effect on July 1, 2007 and would have an impact in that first year. The impact depends upon how many new plans there are developed or substantially altered and just how fast that increment value or the value growth above the base closing value when the plan is started, how fast that grows and the school district share of that. So I'll do some revision on the numbers.
Okay, so the revenue impact that we have in front of us should not be.
Well, the first year, I believe, would still be about roughly $75,000, assuming that there would be five new plan areas as has occurred in the last 2 years. But after that, the growth has to be adjusted.
Questions for Mr. Meyer? Senator Schrader, is he? We do have a number of folks signed up, all opposed, so that's why I want to give I like to give the person who's more supportive an opportunity before folks line up to talk about why they don't like it. Senator Schrader, you're up, and then we'll hear from folks who are not as enamored with your ideas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. Another non-controversial bill of mine that I appreciate your hearing here today.
Senate Bill 28 is an attempt to do something I know the chair is very interested in, and that's to make sure that there's an opportunity for capital construction for our K-12 system. excuse me. As the chair and had some work groups in the interim, I was unfortunately not able to participate in some of those exercises, but my interest has been long towards trying to help our schools build and not raise taxes at the same time. How do you build schools and not raise taxes and not take money out of the general fund or the operating funds? So a simple solution occurred to me that we have urban renewal districts, and unfortunately, I think inadvertently, a chunk of the urban renewal district money that goes for capital construction, good capital construction, economic development in our various districts and cities and counties, comes out of what would ordinarily have gone for, you know, school bonds or school construction potential or school operating levy. So the tax base that is my simple solution was the tax base that is currently being diverted from the school system into capital development for economic development could still stay true to the urban renewal mantra of capital construction only, yet we use it for capital construction for school buildings. And that's basically all this bill does. It's a very simple, very straightforward bill. Enables the diversion of the school district's money for capital construction to be used for capital construction, but for schools. So I think it's a fairly elegant little solution to a dilemma that's been facing our school districts for some time, and doesn't undermine our urban renewal districts and their ability to raise money for other capital economic projects.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Kurt, would the capital construction have to be inside the urban renewal district? In other words, would it have to be used for a school building within the urban renewal district?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I don't have a really good answer. Officially, yes, it would, I suppose. But I'd be open to the committee's wisdom on if there's an opportunity, given current statutory law, to work with that.
And urban renewal districts, as you know, are sometimes just pieces of school districts, and the need may not be in that.
Yeah, that's
case.
A very good point, Senator.
Over here instead.
It's a good point. Good point. I hadn't worked on that.
Other questions for Senator Schrader? Whoever, if you have your cell phone on, if you could please turn it off, that would be fantastic.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I had the same question. I guess I would have a concern that if there weren't a need for a school within that urban renewal district, then what would happen to the money for that? I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to build a school where one wasn't needed. So I'm just wondering if there's any flexibility, any kind of test to see if school buildings actually are needed.
I'd be open to that. That's a very good point.
Other questions for Senator Schrader? Thank you for bringing this issue up. It's there is tension between every time an urban renewal district is extended or issued and the interplay that has on schools and fire and police, and sometimes I don't think that is as elevated, and so these bills help at least the state elevate the issue, and certainly we come in as both funders of schools and allowing the urban renewal districts to occur.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the language talks about improvement projects as well as capital construction, so I assume that if improvements could be made to existing school buildings, that a new one wouldn't have to be required.
Thank you. Okay, I was about to call Tim Nesbitt, Elizabeth Harshenko, and Michael Graney, but that is not this bill. You can come up, Mr. Graney. I would surprise all of us if you were on urban renewal, but that would. Bruce Warner, the head of PDC, Portland Development Commission, Steve Bryan, with the League of Oregon Cities, and Wes Hare with the City of Albany. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A pleasure to be here. For the record, Bruce Warner, as you point out, the Executive Director of the Portland Development Commission. I do want to talk about Senate Bill 28. And I think my testimony is being distributed to you right at this moment. I do want to state that the Portland Development Commission and the City of Portland understand the vital role that schools play in Portland and in Oregon, and you have to have healthy schools to have a healthy community. We have six school districts in the City of Portland, and many of them have urgent capital and deferred maintenance needs. And I want to make it clear that we do applaud the efforts of this committee and Senator Schrader to develop legislation to provide funding for the school's capital construction needs. However, as pointed out in my testimony, I believe that Senate Bill 28 is the wrong approach and would and could have a potentially irreparable harm to urban renewal statewide. In the third paragraph, I just wanted to point out that we in Portland are committed to partnering with our public schools. We have a lot of things going on with them. We're working in a schools, family, housing initiative with them to with Portland Public Schools to really look at some of the schools that are losing enrollment, some of the vacant school sites, surplus school sites they have, and vacant land owned by the Portland Public School District, and an ability to provide family housing around many of those schools. And I noted many of the urban renewal areas and the projects we're working on to provide, again, family housing that will bring children back into those areas to keep those schools vital, and to also utilize existing school sites that are not being utilized for education anymore and provide revenue sources for Portland Public Schools. And what I wanted to point out is at minimum, the projects we currently have on the books are about $12 million worth of projects that in this partnership. I would also point out that we're in the early stages of discussion with the Portland Public Schools about exploring the possibility of a new K through 8 school in the River District. We'd like to see some folks with families and children remain downtown. I also noted in the last paragraph in the first page that we are engaged in David Douglas School District, and their needs are considerably different than the Portland Public School, and we're also working with the Parkville School District. And if you turn the page, I just wanted to point out that we don't do just economic development. It's all part of a plan to aid the community. And we have been working very closely, for example, with Multnomah County. And this last year's budget, we have $9 million that are being transferred to the city, or excuse me, to Multnomah County for the initial steps of siting a new courthouse adjacent to their existing Portland Justice Center. And we're also using urban renewal to do projects like renovation of the Hooper Detox Facility, which includes housing and other amenities to really deal with some of the other social needs in those areas. So the guts of my testimony is right there in the two bullets. Senate Bill 28, as was pointed out, would require parceling out of increment that would have otherwise gone to the school districts and dedicated to school capital construction. By requiring this mandatory pass-through, the bill violates two elements which we think are critical to a successful urban renewal agency. First off, in terms of equity, we don't believe legislation should not permit jurisdictions to inequitably receive benefit of an urban renewal investment without assuming some of the risk and the costs associated with that. So in other words, what happens is the jurisdictions that remain in the investment pool must pay the costs over a longer period of time, which usually, as you know, if it takes longer to build something, it costs more to build it also. And so requiring a mandatory pass-through or an opt-out, as some of the legislation is being considered, really does result in winners and losers. The next piece of it in terms of investment, as you heard, all of the urban renewal plans that are put together for a particular area are based on a series of investments that are put together to really substantially provide investment to provide a catalyst for growth and property taxes, again, the wealth of the neighborhood and jobs and housing. So the important thing about urban renewal, I think you all know that sooner or later the revenue is not lost to the taxing districts, because when the taxing districts, or excuse me, the urban renewal districts are terminated, those monies and bonds are paid off, those monies actually come back in the form of new tax revenues to the district. And I would point out that we believe in the next couple of years there will be two additional districts in Portland which will be retired and will move forward in terms of getting those bonds paid off to get that back on the tax roll. So in conclusion, Mr. Chair and committee members, those two principles, I think the bill would choose schools as a winner and other taxing districts as losers. And it doesn't create underlying jurisdictions equally. And secondarily, the bill does not consider the investment model. because for some urban renewal districts, capital school construction may be a key portion of the investment model and plan, even to a greater degree to which the bill requires. However, as was pointed out by Senator Monroe and other districts, capital school construction may not be a portion of the investment model, and without further changes, you would not be able to spend those monies outside of that particular district. So, again, and final statements, I understand that the committee is considering a couple other options to deal with school capital needs, and I urge you to consider an option that doesn't have what I think is a detrimental effect to urban renewal statewide. Thank you.
Thank you. How many urban renewal districts has Portland terminated there in the last, say, 10 years?
In the last 10 years, Mr. Chair, I can't answer that, but I would say it's probably at least two. I think we've had four or five over the life of the agency, but I will get that to your staff so we can give you a good answer with the districts and the dates, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, and I'm going back 2 years now to got a chart in my head. What's the oldest urban renewal district in PDC's territory, or?
I would think the oldest one is probably our downtown waterfront, which is one of the main ones for right, dealing with issues right down the central core area of the city of Portland.
Old?
And I want to say it's not quite 20 years old.
So the obvious question at that, or the question that pops into my mind, is at 20 years, is it still benefiting? And that's always the question. I'm sure you and the board of PDC are trying to actively do the trade-offs. Is it still benefiting in year 19, year 20, if it's extended again? Is it still benefiting those school, police, and fire at that point? And at what point would it expire and really show that benefit?
Well, what you just point out is we have two districts that are going to expire in 2008. One of them is a downtown waterfront urban renewal area, and the other one is the South Park blocks, which is right in that same era, which is down the Portland State area. And both of those, we've got some pretty clear direction from our council and from our commission that we should terminate those, maybe do some minor extensions to reach the maximum indebtedness to get to some of those other projects, a lot of housing, for example, in terms of those areas where the great needs for affordable housing. But the intent is that those do need to terminate, and we need to get those back on the tax rolls as quickly as possible.
The other question I would have, and I maybe tap Bruce, your experience in Washington County, I don't have the chart. Again, it was a chart that we looked at a couple years ago. But it was Washington County, who obviously has not used urban renewal to any great or even minor extent that I probably here and there, but certainly not as aggressively as Multnomah. And you saw the payoff to schools in Washington County versus the maybe lack of payoff in Multnomah County to schools. What is your, especially now you had the hat on from Washington County, now you're firmly wearing the PDC hat, how would you respond to someone of, here's the value, though, that Multnomah County is experiencing and the school districts are experiencing because of the TIF investments that we've made.
All right. Mr. Chair, first I would say, even though Washington County itself doesn't have urban renewal, many of the cities within in the county do have urban renewal areas and are actively engaged in urban renewal projects. What I would say is that the expectation that you and I think the law has is that any urban renewal agency or anybody contemplating a creation of a new urban renewal area or extension or amendments to an urban renewal area should be consulting with the local jurisdictions about their needs, and I view, and I think obviously you do, by the changes in this law to make it explicit. If it went forward in terms of the planning, schools do need to be consulted. Their needs need to be on the table, and as I said, we try to do that. And I would hope that anybody, whether it's school needs or fire station needs or operation needs, takes that into account when they actually make the decisions to go forward with any new or amended urban renewal district. Those needs are valid. They need to be addressed, and you can't just do it. You can't roll over those governmental partners. They need to be at the table, and I think we have a commitment to do that, and I believe Washington County, when they get involved in that, will realize, and I think we'll have the same feeling that in order to move forward, they need to have the acquiescence or at least the buy-in and support of all those other jurisdictions, if I'm being responsive to your question.
Yeah, you are, and it's worth noting that they're not here testifying in support or expressing outrage with the PDC or the City of Portland at not being notified. Senator Starr.
Thank you. The local urban renewal district I'm most familiar with is the one that I oversaw when I sat on the Hillsborough City Council, Hillsborough Urban Renewal District. That district really brought you Rondler Acres, Intel Campus, and the redevelopment of Orinco Station area within Hillsborough, and fabulously successful, and the amount of additional value that was created there and how it's benefited not only the city of Hillsborough, but the Hillsborough School District, and I would argue all of Oregon. So there are local communities that are using the tool to really the benefit of all of the taxing districts.
Mm-hmm. And you probably see the property tax values as they've gone up in Rondler Acres and other areas benefiting, hopefully.
Yes. Absolutely. And not only that, but all the public investment that was created on parks and the Hillsborough Stadium. It's been fabulously, and it's a great testament, quite honestly, to the leadership staff of in the city of Hillsborough. Mm-hmm.
And good restaurants, too, right in that area. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Bryant, and I'm the interim legislative director with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm also wearing a hat today as staff representative of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, which is an affiliate organization of the League of Oregon Cities. Based on the comments I just heard, I think I can make my points really briefly because you're singing our tune, which is largely due to the lack of other financial resources in the state of Oregon for economic development. We would argue that urban renewal has become the most effective and most productive economic development tool that we have. We now have 60 cities and counties in the state of Oregon that operate one or more urban renewal districts. And the success stories from those districts, as you just pointed out, Senator Starr, are truly impressive. And we could tell many of those stories. If you're interested, we look forward to the opportunity to do that. They've literally generated thousands of family wage jobs in the state of Oregon. I don't know that we've ever attempted to calculate the income tax dollars that have been created through urban renewal investments back to the state of Oregon. It truly is a phenomenal amount. We've revitalized downtowns through the state of Oregon, and we would argue significantly improved the livability of our communities. I think it's important to note that much of the value that has been created within urban renewal areas only happens because of the investments that we make with urban renewal dollars. You'll hear a story in a minute that we have a lot of property that truly is blighted or has sat fallow and not seen any development activity due to the lack of infrastructure. Urban renewal is often the tool that we use to stimulate investment activity, and results like Rondler Acres can be just terrific. So any mechanism such as this that would literally take one-third of that investment potential away, which this bill would do great damage to the whole concept of urban renewal. Or it would greatly extend the period of time that it takes to pay off the debt in order to return that property back to the tax rolls at its higher value. I think we should point out that this bill does not address all types of urban renewal districts. We have many districts that are entirely industrial. There are no schools located within those districts, and it would not seem appropriate to try to find ways to spend school dollars within those districts. Some are entirely commercial, again, with no school impacts. So a mandatory set-aside to fund improvements that do not address the underlying problem of blight in these districts does not seem like the appropriate tool. On the other hand, as you've heard from Mr. Warner, we have many of our districts that have selectively identified school projects that are appropriate within those districts, and they've partnered with their school districts to make investments in schools to address the problems of blight within those districts. And I don't think there's a fix needed to continue that type of program. And lastly, this bill would provide an impetus for all other taxing districts to request similar consideration. Certainly the fire districts, the library districts, the counties, and other taxing districts could make the same argument that their portion of the tax dollars that is taxed on the incremental value should be returned or dedicated in some way to their exclusive benefit. And of course, once you start down that path, you eliminate urban renewal as an effective tool.
Slippery slope.
That's correct. And then the other thing I should point out is that you may or may not know we are in an active discussion with our partner local governments, the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies have formed an informal work group to start talking, taking a different approach than we took last session, of talking to each other before these bills surface to see if there isn't some common ground that we can find to address some of the difficulties that urban renewal has created for special districts in particular. I think we're having productive discussions, and hopefully if other bills come up that get at those problems, we can come to you with some ideas that might be helpful. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions for Ms. Bryant? Are you all, I've been kind of updated on your negotiations. How are those going?
Well, actually, we had another meeting scheduled at 9 o'clock this morning, but this hearing preempted that, so we're hoping to gather at 11. So okay, hopefully we'll have a good meeting today.
We'll keep things moving.
Then. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wes Hare. I'm the city manager in Albany, Oregon, and my first position in local government was as a school board member and chair in the Bethel School District in Eugene, and it's not heresy for me to say that I still think the first dollar of local tax money should go to education before it goes anywhere else. So just having said that, I'm still not convinced that this is the right approach in Senate Bill 28 to dealing with the issue of school construction. Steve asked me here today to speak about a project that we've been involved in Albany. You may have read last November that PepsiCo committed to building a new facility, a Gatorade and Propel fitness water facility in Albany. Will, if it follows the pattern that they've assured us it will and that they've followed in other states, it will lead to 500 family wage jobs, roughly $50,000 a job, and as much as $500 million in new investment, all of which would occur on a field that has been zoned for industrial use for over 20 years but has been used to grow grass, and there had not been a whole lot of interest in developing this property until the PepsiCo project came along. I can tell you that without any doubt, the project would not happen without urban renewal and without the full revenue from urban renewal. So if this bill were to have been in effect, and actually this bill has sort of a distant possibility of threatening the PepsiCo transaction, if it had been in effect, we wouldn't be doing the project, and the PepsiCo plant would be located in Modesto, California, which was their other top site. Urban renewal is a valuable tool for us to be able to assist with the infrastructure needs to serve, a project of this scope. And again, we are in the process of creating the district right now. Although the district and our plan are likely to be completed before July 1st, there is a 90-day remonstrance period that, in effect could delay implementation and could possibly, if the bill were law, could possibly sink our ability to be able to live up to the commitments that we've made as a city. So I would just argue I would also point out that at the same time that all this was going on, the voters in Albany, by a fairly overwhelming majority, passed a major school construction bond to deal with some issues of growth in our community. I think it was over 60% of the voters voted to build a new school and to provide resources to rehabilitate existing schools. So we have tools available right now that are working in our community. We don't have any other tools to be able to site a plant like Pepsi.
Hmm. And I definitely sense you feel certain that it was that tool that allowed Pepsi to...
At one point when I was meeting with, we had a meeting, sort of how are we going to deal with this project meeting in Salem with representatives from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and we reached a point where we said, okay, here's the gap. And I believe the gap was about $11 million, as I recall. What could we possibly do to fill that gap? And the state had no means. They were only had limited resources available. We weren't sitting on $11 million in sort of speculative development funds. And we said, well, we could consider an urban renewal district, taking advantage of the tax revenue that would be generated from the project and from some additional growth that we anticipate in the immediate area, and be able to do the infrastructure. So, if that wasn't there, and I've been doing this work a long time, I don't know what else we would have used.
Great. Very good testimony. We often hear from critics of urban renewal, and so I think that was a solid defense of the program and the toll that it provides to cities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go B.J. Smith, Gary Cook, and we miss him. Our tax drafter, Dexter Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm B.J. Smith. I'm the Public and Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. I'm also the lobbyist that is accompanying Dexter Johnson back to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I have with me today Gary Cook, who is former director of our development agency, and Dexter is with our county council staff now. I've submitted some testimony, and we'll just punch a couple of highlights for you. Our pattern here is very similar to the pattern of comment that you've heard already. But I did want to remark, we oppose Senate Bill 28, but it does two things that I think are worthy of notice. One is that we've had discussions last session and recently about opt-out issues. And has been discussed by Director Warner, opt-out poses particular problems for urban renewal. It's like taking one card out of a house of cards. And urban renewal ends up looking very inequitable in its treatment to the remaining jurisdictions. One thing that Senate Bill 28 doesn't do is it doesn't opt out. It talks about reinvestment into the urban renewal, the community plan area. And so from that standpoint, I think Senate Bill 28 is a different type of bill. And I do know that you are struggling with the idea of capital construction for schools. We all at the local level are struggling with that as well because it makes our community stronger. The other remark that was made by other speakers is that if you are going to proceed to develop an urban renewal plan, that you do have an obligation to work with your partners and to look at, and there is a statutory reference that says that we really should be looking in our planning process to public facility needs. Now, we often look to transportation, and that's specifically listed, public facilities, recreation. It doesn't actually have the word schools in there, but most of us, from the standpoint of good practice, do look at schools and basically work with our partners at the local level to determine what school needs might be impacted, particularly those in the urban renewal district. So the theory of urban renewal is all really about drawing private investment into an area, but the secondary theory is that drawing private investment into a particular area also means that we have to have livability. And livability comes with some of the public amenities that go there. Our development agency enjoys a solid relationship with the North Clackamas School District. We have worked with North Clackamas Schools to meet some of their needs while meeting our own needs for economic viability. And actually what I would like to do is just ask Gary Cook to talk to you about some of our examples of working with the school district in partnership, and then Dexter will be our last batter up to talk a little bit more about urban renewal.
Great. And I was just notified that we're meeting at 10:15 on the floor today rather than we were 11 yesterday, so they're moving us around. So we've got about 5 more minutes.
Good. I will make this brief then, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Cook.
I wanted to share with you briefly some of the projects that have occurred in the now four urban renewal districts that Clackamas County has. The Clackamas Town Center District has enjoyed a long relationship with North Clackamas School District 12. And to that extent, we've had a result of a situation where the attendance area grows and shifts with urbanization east of I-205 primarily. We have on two occasions bought some surplus property from School District 12. The first one was an elementary school called Batten, which is now located at the intersection of Johnson Creek Boulevard and I-205. That was a historic elementary school that we acquired from School District 12. We turned that around with a development partner, and that now is Clackamas Crossing, which is a large commercial development right at the intersection of Johnson Creek and I-205. The second major property purchase we completed with School District 12 was an elementary and a middle school at Ickeson Harmony. That is now the Clackamas Community College OIT Harmony campus. We bought that with the intended specific notion of reselling the property. We sold the western portion, the Ickes grade school, to Clackamas Community College. They needed to expand their campus from the south end of Oregon City, bring it closer into the metropolitan area, and that is the location they chose. The other transaction was with OIT. That was their first foray from the Klamath Falls area, and that was a very specific economic target, as they brought a lot of metalworking, trades, and education into the Portland metropolitan area, which was a combined target industry of a number of the communities, not just Clackamas County in the metropolitan area, and still remains. We have also partnered with School District 12 in the construction of the Mount Scott Elementary School, which is right on the very periphery of the Clackamas Town Center Urban Renewal District. We put some money into that elementary school to make a full-size adult scale, if you will, gym, and we also put some money into the building to make available some work areas, classrooms in the evening and on the weekends for recreation facilities. At the time, we did not have a Parks and Recreation District, and one of the things that was sadly lacking was parks and recreation areas, particularly in that urban renewal district. Having said that, we've not had the opportunity to repeat that exercise in the other two currently operating districts, one being the Clackamas Industrial Area, whose levy we terminated last June, the other being the Government Camp Village District. And simply put, the reason for that is there are no schools in those two districts. We just didn't have the opportunity. I think the point of the exercise is that we do work very closely with the affected school district, primarily North Clackamas, and where we have the opportunity within the district to team with those folks, we will. I think that parrots the testimony you heard of Mr. Warner at the beginning of your hearing. So having said that, I don't want to take any more time, but would love to respond to any questions if you have any.
How old is the Clackamas Town Center District?
The Clackamas Town Center District was formed in 1980. In 1988, we withdrew the Clackamas Town Center Mall, and by doing that, added about $90 million of assessed value to the rolls. We made another withdrawal in 2005, withdrew 88 acres, basically the Kaiser Hospital Sunnyside 205 area, and that return was another $48 million. So we've added, these are pre-measure 50 numbers, $90 million.
But shrunk.
Yes, correct. We have amended that boundary on two occasions, withdrawing territory and adding assessed value to the rolls.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Assistant County Counsel with Clackamas County.
Okay.
And it's, as always, it's a pleasure to be here. I know time is very brief, so I want to make simply three points concerning Senate Bill 28. First, we believe that urban renewal as an investment tool is simply the wrong tool to use for school construction. Second, we believe that Senate Bill 28 will operate to delay and lengthen the urban renewal financing process, and it's already a long process. And third, we believe that Senate Bill 28 increases the complexity of an already complicated calculation in figuring out what precisely the tax increment revenue division of tax monies are and how they're distributed. And in fact, there's some uncertainty that assessors have the ability to make that calculation, adding this additional complexity to it. Let me return to my first point, however, that being that this is the wrong tool for school construction. Urban renewal is essentially designed to take a small geographic area, often industrial or commercial property, always blighted property, and take some tax dollars and make infrastructure improvements that are designed to bring in private investment and, as a result, increase the overall value. Now, on a community-wide basis, a solid school district adds a great deal of value, but it doesn't within the narrow constructs of a small geographic area, such as an urban renewal district. So there isn't really a linkage between, we believe, between trying to make investments that will add value to a small geographic area by constructing schools there. It just doesn't add the kind of value that the ordinary infrastructure improvements that urban renewal districts undertake now would do. Because it reduces the amount of tax increment revenues, it lengthens the period of time by which the tax increment, the division of tax, goes on for, and thereby negatively impacts all of the other districts by reducing their tax revenues for a longer period of time than existing than the existing process. And as I mentioned before, the calculation is very complicated right now. Assessors are kind of, from what I can tell, at the maximum. They can't make it any more complicated and be able to do it. And I think this bill may have that effect. Those are my points. Be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions for our former guy, Dexter Johnson, or the panel? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add a postscript. On the Clackamas Town Center Urban Renewal District, we are about four projects and one light rail system away from closure on that district. Because it's a highly leveraged district, we've had to wait for a lot of federal transportation money and now transit money as well for the investment cycle to run now.
4 years in that district will expire.
Four projects and the light rail, and how many
it's
years?
Five years.
5 years. Great, thanks. Jeff Toshman, John Wells are our final sign-ups, and any new points? We are about to lose a committee to the Senate floor.
Would you like the testimony now, or?
It is your call, if especially any new points, things that we ought to be thinking about that haven't been put on the record.
Okay. My name is Jeff Tashman. I work with the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, and I just had two points to make. The impact of segregating out the school-generated urban renewal revenues has been characterized as roughly a third. 33% of the revenue to an urban renewal district would be lost except for school construction. On the statewide level, you took all the growth that's happened inside urban renewal districts all over the state, that comprises less than 3% of the assessed value in the state. So it's a high cost to individual urban renewal districts, but even if you could have a bill that would magically generate revenue from every bit of growth inside urban renewal areas statewide, that would be a 3% impact. The only other thing I wanted to mention is that because of changes in the statutes, school district bonds and school district local option levies immediately benefit from growth inside urban renewal areas if it's a plan that was adopted after 2001. So any new bond measure, any new local option levy is completely unaffected by urban renewal, and they immediately access the benefits of growth inside urban renewal areas.
So how so? That's because
the way the law was written?
Yeah, there was a change in the 2001 session, and it created a new class of urban renewal plans. And for that, basically plans adopted after the effective date of that legislation, and they don't, those plans don't divide the taxes for new local option levies or bonds.
Gotcha. Great. That's good to know.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Wales.
Thank you, Chair Deckett and members of the committee. My name is John Wales. I'm the Assistant Director at the Salem Urban Development Department, and I just want to reiterate and confirm that we concur with the testimony that's been provided in opposition to this bill. As you probably are very aware, that Salem views this as, this urban renewal tool as one of the most valuable tools we have for economic development. We are a community that is quite blighted in on a number of fronts. We have a goal from our council for the past 4 years to improve the increase the family wage or the minimum wage for the family wage jobs in Salem. We're lagging the state considerably in this, and this is a vehicle that we have put a lot of resources into, including most recently the opening of the Mill Creek Industrial Park, which is opening up 500 acres for the state of Oregon for a 5,000 jobs, $400 million in investment. And we believe this bill will significantly undermine not only that project, but others in that we have in the process as well. We think that the diversion of funds really is in conflict with, not done in the context of addressing the blighted areas that we're trying to alleviate. So I just want to be on the record to say that we would oppose this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Wales. Could you make the capital an urban renewal zone and upgrade some of the carpet and the furniture and the other? Great. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 28. And, Senator George, thank you for hanging with us here. We are adjourned to the floor session, and we'll convene again at 8:45 on Wednesday.